listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot going on. Ted Cruz has finished his 19-hour stunt. Not my word. I think it was John McCain's, but even Ted Cruz. What's really interesting is when Ted Cruz started this whole thing, this phony filibuster, this long speech, shall we say, he said that anybody who votes for cloture is voting for Obamacare. In fact, here's the clip of him actually saying that, I think. We have that.
Any vote for cloture, any vote to allow Harry Reid to add funding for Obamacare with just a 51-vote threshold, a vote for cloture is a vote for Obamacare.
Yep, there you go. And so this morning they held a vote, and Ted Cruz voted for cloture. So go figure. I guarantee he's raised millions of dollars. His website is just going nuts. So anyhow, we'll get into that a little more as the day goes on. Bill Donovan from the Catholic League is going to be on. The Pope is speaking out about capitalism, and I'm curious to get Wild Bill's thoughts on this. Frank Vernuccio is with us right now. He's the editor-in-chief of the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, usgovpolicy.com, govpolicy.com is the website. And Frank, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you this afternoon.
Thank you. I see from this press release, or I guess it's a press release, where you say that a generation of American students are being indoctrinated rather than educated. You point out the failings. 35% of fourth graders know the purpose of the Declaration of Independence, for example, and you know the lack of proficiency in history. I would add to that civics, but I'm guessing you would agree with me on that. First of all, you want to riff on that a little bit?
Well, according to a number of studies that come out from a whole bunch of different sources, everything from the United States Department of Education down to the National Association of Scholars and a number of state-by-state studies, all indicate that Americans straight from grammar school right through postgraduate don't really have any kind of background or training in American history or civics. In fact, the U.S. Education Department has been saying that about 70% of Americans couldn't pass a basic test in American history or civics.
In fact, and most Americans can't pass the test that you have to pass to become a U.S. citizen.
That's exactly right. Some of the most basic elements in our country. And, of course, the concern of all that is that, you know, going back to Thomas Jefferson, when he talked about the necessity of a good public education, said that we need a public education to have an informed citizenry to make a stable and valid democracy.
Yep.
Now, it looks as though we're losing that at this point in time.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I'm continually astounded by these things. And I'm also, I'm in the boomer generation, and it amazes me when I sit around with millennials, kids younger than my own children, people in their 20s, and talk about things like, the Bill of Rights, et cetera. We used to have to memorize, in fourth grade, we had to memorize the preamble to the Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, we had to read the Constitution, and we had to know what each one of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution said and stood for. We didn't have to memorize them word for word. But that was fourth grade. Fourth grade is like, what, 10 years old? And I'm talking to high school graduates, college graduates now, who could not do that. And what
well, you're
has...
absolutely right.
And this, is, and this seems to have happened in large part since the 1980s, Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the Education Department, Bill Bennett who said, let's do away with the Education Department. And this whole shift, Bill Clinton pushed this stuff, Ted Kennedy pushed it towards standardized testing and education, where it's like, teach to the test and all this stuff. And it just seems to me like our education system on a totally bipartisan basis has gone down the tubes. It's been the victim of politics. Your thoughts on that?
Well, again, it's not only the regular schools. Let's go to the most elite academy in the United States, Harvard University. Now, according to an ISI study, an intercollegiate study, Harvard seniors scored a 69.5% on a basic U.S. history and civics test.
Right.
These are the cream of the crop, and this is the best they could come
up. Right, and this is the stuff, and that's probably because when they went to Harvard, they studied whatever their specialized area of study was, college, pre-80s, most colleges, at least in the first year, you had to take all these basic courses, which include things like history, and pretty much that's not so much the case anymore. And plus, people would have learned that stuff in high school. So what, you know, here's where it gets interesting, though. I noticed in your article, or your press release, or your commentary on this, I guess, you said it's not that what isn't being taught that's troublesome. It's also what is being given a place in standard instruction, a people's history of the United States. So this is Howard Zinn's history book, kind of history of the United States, which you describe as a Marxist view of the United States, was used as a text in Washington, D.C. schools. Have you read Howard Zinn's book?
Yeah, I have, cover to cover, as a matter of fact. And look, there's a lot of historical fact in Howard Zinn's book that can't be denied. On the other hand, a lot of it is pure opinion. And it's part of a collection of works that are used regionally throughout the United States where we're, instead of teaching the basic facts first and then at a different level getting into discussions where Howard Zinn's book might be appropriate, we're using this in many cases as a basic text. Let's go, for example, to Arizona. In Arizona, there is a book by, I'm trying to think of the name, Mr. Richard Acuna, I believe it is, which he talks about the validity of establishing a Chicano nation in the southwest of the United States. And, you know, again, if we're using this as a valid discussion at a college level, that's fine. But at a lower level of high school or grammar school, I think that we're crowding out the basics.
But so back to Howard Zinn. I'm not familiar with Rodolfo
Acuna.
Right. I'm not familiar with Rodolfo Acuna, so I can't debate him with you or discuss him with you. But Howard Zinn, for example, in the People's History of America, of the United States, I mean, you know, he starts out with the genocide of the Indians, the Native American people. When I studied American history, I was not told that Thomas Jefferson ordered the slaughter of Indians or that George Washington, not so much, but I guess, you know, it really went on steroids during the Jefferson administration and particularly with the Louisiana Purchase. I got the sanitized version, right? I got the, you know, the cowboys and Indians and all that. I think all Americans did, by and large, outside perhaps of Indian reservations. Why not teach the fact that this nation was birthed in genocide and slavery? What's wrong with that?
Well, I don't think any fact should be hidden. I think that the facts are facts are facts, and you can't teach history without being honest and being realistic about it. I don't disagree with you with that at all. But if that's all that they're getting, if all that the students are getting is sort of an anti-American history, which we should...
Well, there's nothing anti about that. It's real. I mean, I'm all in favor of teaching the nobility of the idea of self-governance, too, although it was only white men. But still, there was some really, really good Enlightenment thought that came, you know, that created this country. That should be taught, too, should it not?
Oh, again, I have no objection to any fact being taught. It should all be taught. But what we're seeing as a whole is no facts being taught at all.
Yeah.
When, for example, when National Scholar Institute, in a study taken in California, said that the majority, overwhelming majority of the people they polled can't name the three branches of government.
Yeah, this is a disaster. So we have about 30 seconds. What's your solution to this?
Well, number one, I think we have to get back to a basic concept of what needs to be taught in schools. And you hit on it earlier, where, you know, we don't have the core courses, we don't have the basic background in key areas.
Yeah. History and civics in particular.
You're a baby boomer, as am I. Yeah. And we remember taking courses called history and civics.
Right.
Now it's kind of wrapped up into something called social studies, where the actual teaching of factual history is sort of in the background and very lightly glanced over.
Yeah. And to the stuff that is there, it's just the stuff that's like, okay, here's 16 dates you need to memorize. 1492, 1776. You know, we may be looking at this from very, very different political perspectives, Frank, but I think that we are in broad agreement. Frank Vernuccio, the editor-in-chief of New York Policy Analysis of Policy and Government, USA, govpolicy.com. Thanks, Frank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how would you teach history if you were teaching history in class? How should we change this? How do we get out of this? The place where smart people get their news. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. So Ted Cruz done with his thing. Is the state of education in America turning really, really sad. And the conservative response to this, of course, is privatize the schools. You know, the Bobby Jindal. Let's give out vouchers and let the religious people educate our kids so they can learn that the world was created in 6 days and is 6,000 years old. That's going to really help them get into Harvard, turn them into brilliant scientists. I mean, you know, all kinds of cool stuff. So there's that. And I think that, frankly, we need to look at educational models that work. Yesterday I was singing the praises of Goddard College, and not just because they gave me an honorary PhD over the weekend, but I've been affiliated with Goddard for years, and they have a model of education which is fundamentally Socratic. It's you know, you have a mentor, a teacher who is constantly challenging you and the work that you're doing. And it's self-directed, but it's tough. And, you know, so don't go to Goddard if you're looking for a, you know, easy experience. But people love it who don't succeed well in regular public school. People who do also love it. But because it is a student-centered learning. We need to be doing this in our elementary schools. A variation on Waldorf schools, a variation on Montessori schools. We need to be doing all of these things. Education is in a flaming crisis, a screaming crisis in America right now. And it's a crisis that we can do something about. And we really, really need to. Another thing, by the way, we keep learning things about the Affordable Care Act. Of course, conservatives keep getting hysterical about it. It was so interesting to me today. The front page of the Wall Street Journal had an article about the Affordable Care Act, and they grudgingly admitted that health care costs are going to go down for most Americans. But they said, however, a 27-year-old non-smoker in, I think it was New York, will find that health care will cost them $140-some-odd compared to $47 for a high risk policy or a high, you know, what a deductible policy or whatever. And I read that and I just, like, my jaw hit the floor. I mean, this is now I understand why all those journalists quit the Wall Street Journal when Rupert Murdoch bought it. It's like the Wall Street Journal and Fox have become this comfortable, respectable place for right-wingers in America to hang out and talk to each other, basically live in their own little separate universe. Because what they were doing was they were taking the kind of insurance policies, the kind of Walmart policies, the policies that, you know, the first $5,000, the first $10,000 is out of pocket. So they're basically disaster protection plans. That's all they are. They're arguably insurance, but really? And they compared one of those plans with an Obamacare plan, which is actual health insurance. I mean, the bottom plan might not be the world's best health insurance, but hey, it's health insurance. So we're going to be learning more about this as time goes on. And in fact, we've been talking with a couple of folks about just doing an hour here, another Q&A hour on Obamacare. We did that a week or so ago with Wendell Potter, and it was very popular. And we've been talking to Wendell. We've been talking to the folks at the White House about maybe they've got somebody who really is an expert on Obamacare, come on the program and just basically answer all your questions. So I think that should be very interesting. Craig in Jamaica, New York. Hey, Craig, thanks for calling. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Good afternoon. From Jamaica, it's more than a beach. But
indeed.
What I'd like to say about the educational system, I think it's a type of mental laziness we've gotten into because of the convenience of the modern technology. Look, now if you lost your phone records out of your cell phone, nobody would remember who to call. At one time, you were walking around from the baby boomer generation. You had at least 10 or 15 numbers in your head at all times, your mother's number, your brother, your 9 best friends.
Yeah.
And whatever was important to you was in your head. Now nobody knows that anymore. And for some reason, critical thinking is not extolled, even though we know that that's what makes people better at whatever they're trying to do, is to think critically about it. But it's sort of it's like people think you talk too much if you're critically thinking, you know, yeah. So they want quick answers, like as if they were getting it from a computer. But one more thing, Tom, I'd like to say about the health care. The Republicans are sort of like, this is the last gasp of a dying party. You sort of see that they know that how much mileage Roosevelt got out of Social Security.
Yeah, got him reelected three times.
Yeah, and God forbid that a black president should get the same kind of mileage out of the health care thing. And people always have said, well, it seems like the Democratic Party, even if it's not totally true, has the image of helping the people.
Yeah.
So the last thing the Republicans want is that image going on.
Oh, they're terrified. They're absolutely terrified, Craig, of Obamacare being successful. Let me just put a punctuation point on your education comments. I wrote in my book, Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD, there's a whole chapter, two chapters devoted to the history of education going back to Queen Teresa of Austria back in the 1700s when she created the Spinnenschulens, where half the day that the kids would learn and the other half of the day they spun cloth, and this, you know, and this was how their parents were compensated for, you know, this is how they'd get their parents to give free labor to the company. And the Industrial Revolution turned our school system kind of became like factories where every child is the same and we're just turning them out on an assembly line. It wasn't horrible. It wasn't a particularly good one. And the pushback to that was Montessori and Steiner. But now we've gone a step further with the computers, as you point out, where it's not even, you know, we're not even running on an industrial age factory model. We're now running on kind of a computer model. And every child is expected to have computer skills and technical skills. In other words, to be able to find stuff, but not necessarily be able to know it or to understand its significance. Craig, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So should we get all the computers out of our classrooms or not? Does it have anything to do with it at all? Is it just a mindset? Is it just the way we're thinking now? Chuck Schumer is saying that the Ted Cruz actually advanced their agenda. That's a fascinating thought. Anyway, let me get all these books out of the way here. So Ted Cruz, Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on KBCS 91.3 FM, has some thoughts on this. You think blue state senators should be like Ted Cruz?
I want to say how grateful I am that the unique perfume from the Yellow Rose of Texas wafted through our Senate well for 21 hours yesterday. it takes a special man with a lot of courage, and you can see it in his unflinching, deep soulful eyes, in the strength and power of his voice as he recites Dr. Seuss. And, you know, it really takes a brave man to steal health care from
millions of children.
Homeless people, poor people, children, teenagers,
yeah.
Elderly. It really takes guts to do that. And hats off to Ted Cruz.
Yeah. Now, you know, the flip side of this is that Bernie Sanders did something very similar in his 9-hour filibuster, I think it was, which has been turned into a book, The Speech. But Bernie actually voted against the legislation that he was opposing. I mean, Bernie voted against the Patriot Act. He voted against the war. He's voted against a lot of legislation that a lot of Democrats compromised on with Republicans. He's just unwilling to compromise generally and, you know, has the courage of his convictions. Ted Cruz started this thing out by saying that if any senator were to vote for cloture, which is, you know, okay, let's move on and consider this piece of legislation, if any senator voted for it, they were voting for Obamacare. Here's Ted Cruz early on, you know, in his little filibuster thing.
Any vote for cloture, any vote to allow Harry Reid to add funding for Obamacare with just a 51-vote threshold, a vote for cloture is a vote for Obamacare.
So Ted Cruz said that, and then this morning, guess what Ted Cruz voted for, Kirk?
I know what he voted for. You told us a little while ago. He voted for cloture.
There you go. He said, "Okay, we're gonna consider this." In fact, it was 100-0 was the vote in the Senate for cloture to move on and consider it. It's almost like the Republicans were saying, "Okay, Ted, we're done with that." In fact, Chuck Schumer says Ted actually advanced our cause, so it's a good one. Kirk, thanks for the call. Mike in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again. In terms of education, I think this is a, man, this is a Herculean topic. And I've been studying this myself in quite detail in academia, too, of which Howard Zinn is a huge part of it.
Yes.
Real quick point on your caller who made the comment along the lines of the American, the anti-American views of history. The problem with that fallacy of that argument is that Howard Zinn is actual empirical erudition of American history. It's not an opinion.
Mm.
When the genocide of the Arawak or the Pequot Indians happened, that's not an opinion. That actually did happen.
Yes.
So in terms of education, I think what we need to move towards is a national curriculum and a national educational policy. But the problem with that is what Lowy warned us about in the 60s, which is you know, special interest liberalism. And people have, through the channels of democracy, formed sort of a mob rule mentality when it comes to, like, Christian advanced education. We hear people like Dawkins talk about this. And what they're doing, Christian-based education, is they're condensing education. Not so much, I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were raised and when we went to school, we went to religion class. And we went to science class. And we went to English class and mathematics, so on and so forth. In Christian advanced education, there is no religion class.
That's right. Everything is wrapped in it. It's, if you're going to do math, you use Bible examples. If you're going to do science, you use Bible examples. If you're going to do, if I have this right.
Burrito. Right.
Yeah.
So the problem is that outside of our general special interest problem in the United States that guns so hard for the privatization of education, which will only be, I can't imagine the consequences, and I'm sure you cannot either.
Yeah. Well, the other problem is that our textbooks are published nationally, but the textbook manufacturers cater to the largest purchaser, the largest state that has specific educational standards. And that state, tragically, is Texas. So the Texas Board of Education defines the curriculum for the United States. Last year they said, let's teach less Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, and let's include Phyllis Schlafly and Newt Gingrich in the curriculum as people who significantly changed America.
Right, and if you're someone like myself who's, you know, I'm 40, I've been at this a little while, I haven't been in it as long as you, and I plan on being in this for the long haul and learning from people like you and continuing to do the work of people like Zinn. I mean, I could never come that close. I don't mean to compare myself to that, but the movement where kids are now and what they can identify in terms of history, in terms of geography, in terms of civics and culture, it's shocking compared to where you and I were at a comparable age, you know, 10, 12, 14 years old.
Oh, there's been such a change since the Reagan Revolution. There's been such a change.
In terms of I think in the national curricula itself, if you read it deep enough, it's not glaring, but it's very tacitly Christian.
And this is one of the problems with the national curriculum. I'm very, very ambivalent about this. I do think that there should be certain national standards, but, you know, I'm haunted by that year that I lived in Germany. I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I read a number of Hitler's speeches and listened to a couple of them. And basically what he was saying was, you know, we're going to create 1,000 years of peace. And you know, that was the Third Reich, 1,000 years of peace. One guy in charge. One government, you know, ein Reich, ein Führer, ein Welt. And the centralization, I think that there is a lot. This is why Bernie Sanders doesn't support a national single-payer health system. He thinks that we should have a state-by-state like they do in Canada. Every state should administer their own single-payer health care system so that, you know, they can localize it, so they can localize it to their needs, and so that there's a constant competition for improvement. And I think that there's something to be said on state-by-state basis doing that with education. It's just that we have this national textbook problem, and this has to do with money, and it has to do with capitalism and everything else. But no easy answers. Mike, I got a whole bunch of other callers here. I want to get some more voices in. Thank you for calling. Great to hear from you. Robert in Joliet, Illinois. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great.
I guess I just want to piggyback on top of what a gentleman before me was saying, but I feel like if we learn from our past, then the future will be better. I'm 26, and I was a victim, I would say, of the No Child Left Behind Act, and I don't feel like I was properly educated in high school. And they got rid of critical thinking when I was in elementary, and I noticed it being phased out. And I feel like all those things were important to basically, I feel, dumbifying of our youth.
Yeah.
And I feel like we need to learn from our past, especially, if, you know, the genocide of the Native Americans. I think we need to learn that so that as citizens we could become better from our past and learn from all that and learn not to do that to our to the future and to other countries and to our fellow citizens and the people around us, and we just as a country become better.
I agree. And Robert, I also agree with your with the notion. I'm not sure if you meant to say it explicitly, but the critical thinking at a young age is an important part. It's an important developmental milestone. It's something that kids need to learn and need to do in order to become well-rounded adults. And because we're not teaching critical thinking, because we're not teaching Socratically, because we're not doing the child interacts with the teacher and with the rest of the classroom in a way that is challenging their thinking and their worldview continuously, because we're not doing that, we're turning out a nation of yes men and robots, and it's not a good thing. Robert, thank you for the call and for sharing your story. Larry in Edmonds, Washington. Hey, Larry.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom, for your program. And I wanted to mention that the National Exchange Club, which is a group of businessmen, educators, and what have you, has a curriculum for high school on nationalism. And within that, they're the only group that can photograph all the documents in Washington that pertain to civics and so forth are on the walls of the high school, which we select. After the teacher has taught the civics lesson, which is takes, I think, 2 weeks, the child that is, or the student, rather, who is taught and so forth, gets a special monetary award for success. The teachers love it, and the kids enjoy it. So it's been successful across the nation. I know it certainly is in Edmonds Woodway High School.
Yeah, well, that's marvelous. That's marvelous. And this is the National Exchange Club. I'm not familiar with this. Is this sort of like a Rotary Club? Is this a group of people who are doing civic work?
Similar. We're basically dedicated to the prevention of child abuse.
Uh-huh. And there are groups all around the country.
Yeah, there are groups all around the country, and they started off first painting barns for early airplanes.
Really?
Because no direction they were in. Yeah, they were one of the groups.
Remarkable. So it's just a group of people who are committed to the good of the nation, as it were. Larry, thanks for the heads up on that. I was unaware of the groups at the National Exchange Club. I'll have to check it out. And thanks for watching us there in Edmonds, Washington. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking the truth to multinational corporations we'd really rather you didn't know all about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So first, we undo No Child Left Behind, because it's like No Child Left Behind in the factory. Really? School out there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a quick special guest here, Michael Elliott, who is the president and CEO of the One, O-N-E, campaign, as in one.org, previously was the editor of Time Magazine International Edition, deputy managing editor of Time Magazine prior to One, also a columnist on the global economy for Fortune Magazine. And Michael, and welcome to the program, first of all.
I delight to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. Tell us about One. Is this the program that Bono or...
Exactly.
Okay.
So this is the campaigning organization that Bono was the co-founder of. So we're an advocacy and campaigning body that that works with governments around the world to make sure that resources continue to flow to fight extreme poverty and preventable disease, particularly in Africa. So we lobby in the U.S. and the U.K., all over Europe and elsewhere. We make sure that money continues to go to fight poverty, to fight AIDS, TB, malaria. And we're backed up by an army of 4 million people around the world who sign letters, sign petitions, call their congressman, what have you.
Who go to one.org and find out what you're up to. AIDS, HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, these conditions don't exist in a vacuum. I've spent a fair amount of time in the third world. I've done international relief work for 38 years. And there does seem to be a fairly, and at least in my mind, a fairly clear association between poverty and these things. And not just individual poverty, national poverty as well. The lack of infrastructure, the lack of healthcare infrastructure, the lack of sanitary infrastructure, things like that. What in your, first of all, would you agree or disagree with that comment? And secondly, in either case, what are the solutions in your mind?
Oh, I 100% agree with what you've just said. And I think one of the key solutions is to recognize that many of the parts of the world that look as if they're really poor are sitting on top of resources that could make them very, very rich. You've got some of the poorest people in the world sitting on top of oil, gas, mineral resources, what have you. And if those resources could just be freed up and used for the benefit of people so that they build schools and hospitals and roads rather than be kind of siphoned away into the pockets of corrupt officials, everyone would be better off. And that was one of the key things that Bono was talking about when he was here in New York, where I'm talking to.
But do we really, you know, given the reality of climate change, if we're talking to a, for example, a lot of the work that I've done recently has been in northern South Sudan, around the Darfur area, Gok Machar. We actually did our show for a week from this little town of 7,000 people that's now 47,000 people because of Darfurian refugees. And they're finding oil along the northern border of South Sudan. And so North Sudan or Sudan, Mr. Bashir's government, the war criminal, has been moving his border south. He's been bringing his soldiers in.
Sure.
The Chinese are buying up these oil lots. The Norwegians are helping them meter this stuff. And the Dinka people are, by and large, caught in the middle, and they're being slaughtered. And wouldn't it be, rather than helping with the development of oil, which is what the Chinese and the Norwegians would say that they're doing, wouldn't it be better to be going in and leapfrogging over this 19th century energy source and do as I know a number of good NGOs are doing very aggressively, and I've seen personally in India, for example, in rural India, going in and solarizing villages that have never had electricity before, go directly from no electricity to solar panels for the community and pumps, wells. In Gok Machar, they have one pump, one well. This is kind of high desert land, and the women run this thing 24/7. It's got a hand crank on it. If they simply had a good solar panel and a pump on that thing, people, they get a heck of a lot more water out of it, if nothing else. What are your thoughts on that?
About eight different separate thoughts. I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right. You're 100% right that somewhere like Africa, but the developing world generally, definitely needs to develop its renewable resources, which have barely been scratched in many places, so that energy can be provided as clean as possible. If we're going to power Africa, something that we're completely committed to at the One Dot, at the One Campaign, then we have to do it in a better way than we powered Western Europe and North America, and that means doing it as cleanly as possible. Now, in some parts of the developing world, that won't be possible solely by renewables, and we can't wait for renewable technology to come online. And don't forget, what we're looking for here when we talk about power in Africa is not just kind of a few lights. You know, what we're looking for is an economic transformation. People need jobs. People need jobs, and that means they need factories, they need places where people can work. But you're entirely right that the whole renewable field needs to be kind of massively developed.
Well, and the other problem with oil is what we saw in Nigeria, for example. Widespread corruption, huge environmental devastation.
So the question is, what can one do to address that?
Yes.
And that's really, that's really where the rubber meets the road. And that's what Bono was talking about when he was here in New York yesterday. The way to tackle corruption is transparency. There's a vaccine for corruption, and it's transparency. And it's making sure that the oil, gas, and extractive companies publish exactly what they pay for the right to take out extractive, so that civil society organizers, you know them, I know them, in the developing world can see that data, follow the money, and hold people to account.
Why not call for nationalization like Norway and Venezuela have done?
For making sure that it's spent in the right way. And the kind of great tragedy of the great tragedy of the transparency revolution right now is that the U.S. was in the lead on this a couple of years ago with tremendous legislation that we played a key role in getting passed, the Cardin-Lugar amendment, and that legislation is now stalled because the American Petroleum Institute brought a lawsuit against the SEC, and the SEC has had to go back and rewrite the rules. So Bono was essentially saying yesterday, look, there's a transparency revolution going on that makes sure that money is going to be spent so that it really benefits people. Everyone needs to get on the same side and kind of make sure that it really happens.
But see, even, you know, the Saudi sheikhs are not going to be in favor of that any more than the corrupt Nigerian local warlords.
Well, the question is, let's start with making sure this legislation is already in place in Western Europe, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So any company that is quoted on a European stock exchange has to publish what it pays.
Hmm.
That legislation is present in the U.S. The SEC made rules, and a lawsuit delayed the rules.
So in other words, like BP and Shell, which are European-based companies, they have to comply with this. ExxonMobil doesn't.
We have to create a global standard on this, and we can do so. And you know what? We can get the Saudi sheikhs on site.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay. Thank you very much. Michael Elliott, President and CEO of the One Campaign, one.one.org is the website. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I've been sort of tongue-in-cheek saying for some weeks now that I might consider converting to Catholicism, having been raised a Methodist. And because this Pope Francis, keeps saying these extraordinary things. This was not widely reported. I read it in the Financial Times day before yesterday. And I came back, I was on a flight back from Seattle Monday, and picked up the Financial Times at the Denver airport where I was changing planes, and read this article on the plane. And then when I got back here, I thought, maybe I can find this in the New York Times. I searched the New York Times, couldn't find it, couldn't find it in the Washington Post, couldn't find it pretty much anywhere else, these quotes. Other than the Financial Times. But the Pope was speaking in a little mining town in Sardinia, one of the poorest regions of Italy. And the miners were chanting, work, work, work. And the Pope said, where there is no work, there is no dignity. It is not a problem of Italy and Europe. It is the consequence of a world choice of an economic system that brings about this tragedy. An economic center that has a system that has at its center an idol, which is called money. He said, we have a widespread preoccupation with profits, and today's throwaway culture enslaves the hearts and minds of us all. Greed, the Pope said, is a sin against the first commandment. One cannot worship God and money. Here is why. Money becomes idolatry, and Jesus tells us that you cannot serve money and God. It must be one or the other. It's been a long time since we've heard a Pope talk like this, and we had some speculation yesterday, one of our callers, about his being a Jesuit. That might influence it or whatever, but I wanted to get Bill Donahue on. He's the president and CEO of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. CatholicLeague.org is the website. And Bill has traditionally been associated with or affiliated as or identified as a conservative, and certainly on issues like abortion and gay rights, I'm sure Bill still holds that position. But, Bill, welcome to the program, or welcome back to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. I'm curious your take on this Pope's basically condemning capitalism and promoting things like worker-owned co-ops, and he came right out a couple of weeks ago and said that rich people, that nobody basically should have over $1 billion, that rich people are the problem.
Well, look, the Catholic Church has always been opposed to socialism, and it's always been opposed to unfettered capitalism, the kind of licentious capitalism that some people seem to like, the kind of laissez-faire without any kind of regulations whatsoever. That's been consistent for a long time. When he talks about the throwaway culture last Friday on September the 20th, he said he condemned abortion as part of the throwaway culture.
I understand. So, Union workers
and rights of workers, the Catholic Church has long championed that, going back at least until 1891 with an encyclical Rerum Novarum.
So would you say that conservative Catholics in the United States who call themselves politically conservative, we acknowledge your position on abortion, birth control, you know, the role of women, those gays, those social issues. Let's set that aside for a minute and talk economic issues. You said the church has always been opposed to socialism. What are you calling socialism?
Well, exactly what the term means, the state ownership of the means of production.
Okay, so you're using Marx's term as opposed to Norway's term, because Norway calls itself a socialist country, and yet the state does not own the means of production or manufacturing.
The proper term for the Scandinavian countries, and I'm not being snappy here,
is democratic socialism.
The proper term would be welfare state.
Well, or democratic. They call themselves democratic socialists.
Well, I'm sure that they do, but in socialism strictly defined, and yeah, Marx would be like the guru there, is the state ownership. For example, in Pennsylvania, they will lock you up if you try to open up your own liquor store, all right? Because it's the state run. It's and the socialist, whenever you have socialism,
same in New Hampshire,
no dissent and things of that nature. So they won't tolerate a market a choice for people. That's an example of socialism. Social Security and welfare are examples of a welfare state.
And yet, the Catholic Church in most of Europe, for most of its history, controlled the means of production and manufacture.
They did, until it crashed and Margaret Thatcher had to devolve into a privatized system. That's true.
Well, no, I'm talking about like from 1200 or maybe 800 until the Enlightenment.
I would think that's more mercantilist, Tom, where you had the throne working with a kind of a crony capitalist, not real capitalism, where you might have some kind of a market economy,
right.
As such. But no, I mean, if the state runs the Amtrak, for example, that's an example of socialism, where the state owns the railroad as such. But if it's a matter of a welfare state, that's a different
situation. Well, if the state owns and maintains the highways, is that socialism?
I suppose you could say that
where does the common begin and end?
Roads, though, you see, like David Geffen, for example, says no one's allowed on his beach to go across his beach to get to a public beach. That would be an example there of a private property exercise trying to keep the poor away from his property, so that he doesn't see them walk into the public beach.
Right, but the point of my question was, how do we define where the commons begins and ends? If we agree that the purpose of government in a non-communist or socialist state, to use your word, is to protect the commons, those things that most appropriately are held in trust by all of us, and to protect the right of private citizens and private capital to engage in manufacture and commerce and transportation and sale and distribution and those kind of things, then where do we draw the line? Do we draw the line, you said Amtrak is socialism. I would say Amtrak is an extension of roads. It's transportation. And it, you know, it could be privatized or not. It would be the decision of the people. But if it's not privatized, I don't see that as socialism.
I think that we live in most of the West. There's a large public sector and there's a large private sector.
Right.
So the question is, do you tilt one way or the other? I mean,
right.
do you
draw those lines?
Do you like more of a competition?
So here's
which one do you want to emphasize?
Yeah, I agree. And here, and pardon me for moving this along, but we're going to get hit by a break here in about a minute. So as a Catholic who agrees, I believe. Do you agree with the Pope on these statements?
I do, but you see that. I guess the difference.
So what happens when you say that to Bill O'Reilly and his head explodes?
I see people who run governments in a socialist model as being some of the greediest people I've ever seen. For example, we know that the Somocistas in Nicaragua were an example of crony capitalists who exploited the people. They were replaced by the Sandinistas, who were also exploiting the people, living in the same palaces as the Somocistas. Sometimes you're just talking about rotten guys on both sides.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but the question is, if the Pope says you know money becomes idolatry, you cannot serve both money and God. It must be one
of the
other.
I agree with that.
Greed is a sin against the first commandment, and yet Bill O'Reilly or perhaps the guy who does the libertarian rants on Fox would say, without greed, you don't have capitalism. You don't have a functioning economic system.
Well, you see, that's where I would be more with you, probably, and that is to say, while I believe, maybe strong, a little stronger than you, in a market economy, I do think that the single-minded pursuit of profit is simply wrong and ultimately unchristian.
Wow. I'm impressed. Bill Donahue, I applaud you for your Catholic consistency, and thanks for sharing your perspective with us.
But thank you for being so honest, too.
My pleasure. CatholicLeague.org is Bill Donahue's website. He's the president and CEO of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Did I have to recalibrate the way they view the world, especially conservative Catholics? 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Valerie in Chicago. Hey, Valerie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for everything you do. I just wondered if you had heard of this teacher in Virginia named John Hunter, funny resonance there with Hunter College, but nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. He is the most amazing guy. There was a PBS film. It's called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Have you heard about this guy?
I have not.
Oh, well, you need to look at him. I'm going to try to post something on your website.
Okay.
He has come up with a... excuse me, I'm walking a dog and I'm a little
out of
breath. Let me calm down. He's come up with a game that he plays with his class. It's a public school class. Mm-hmm. That the object of the game is to achieve world peace.
Hmm.
And there are very specific criteria, and it's just amazing. It'll blow your mind. And I feel like this is what we need. This is the teaching of critical thinking in action.
And probably geography
amazing,
as well.
Amazing teacher. Oh, geography, history, politics. He is so competent in his understanding of all of the various agendas and what information is known and what is not known. And, you know.
And he's doing this with fourth graders.
He's doing this with fourth graders who are so excited. It's an 8-week project, I guess, that they sign on for.
Right.
And the way that you achieve world peace has to do with, conflict resolution and making sure that resources and money are shared and agreements are made and international law is followed. And the only way to win the game is to achieve world peace.
Yeah.
And there's a PBS documentary. I think it won some awards, but if you Google world peace and other fourth grade achievements, you'll see all kinds of stuff. There's a lot of Facebook about it.
I just made a note of it. Valerie, I'll track it down. Valerie, thanks a lot. Thanks for the heads up, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Linda in Daly City, California, listening on Progressive Voices. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment about what you were talking about with social studies and kids not learning history.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happens with geography. They do not learn geography anymore, and it's all because history and geography and civics have all been rolled into this one rubric of social studies.
Right.
And I ask friends who are teachers, why don't you teach geography? And they say, well, we're scared to. And why are you scared? Well, we don't know it very well. It was never taught to us. And so this goes back two or three generations of teachers.
Right. And social studies really, in my opinion, should be about things like the philosophy, the history of philosophy, the history of the Enlightenment, and the Renaissance, you know, how thinking has changed over the centuries, comparative religions, comparative cultures,
Cultures, human interactions, how human beings interact, maybe more of the sociology and social studies.
Right. Things like hierarchy, patriarchy, how societies are organized. Those should be the appropriate purview of social studies rather than geography, history, geography and history. Yeah. And civics.
There's a young man who lives across the street from me, and he just turned 18, and he does chores for us because we're disabled. But his parents are boat people from Vietnam. He was born here.
Uh-huh.
So he's kind of a blank slate, and I kind of find out what he's learning in school and what he doesn't know to fill in the empty spaces. And it was not until he was a junior in high school that he learned that there were three branches of government.
Whoa. That's so sad.
And that kind of scares me.
Yeah.
Now, I gave him a copy of Howard Zinn's book and said, read it in your spare time.
You know, there's a new version out in comic book form of Howard Zinn's book, an illustrated.
Oh, I have to get that.
Yeah, it's much more accessible to young people. Okay. Linda, thank you for the heads up, and thanks for sharing your thoughts. I appreciate it, and for listening on Progressive Voices. Scott in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on We Act Radio out of Washington, D.C. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you, to begin with, for your dedication to peace. Really warms my heart when you speak against violence and peace around the world.
Thank you.
I did all I could online as well recently to try to turn things away from war in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And things are looking a little better now, anyway.
They are, and I am so glad that the American people have rejected Bushism or the Bush Doctrine or whatever, and that either President Obama rejected it or he was forced to reject it. I'm so glad.
I understand his speech. I haven't read it that he just gave at the United Nations was somewhat militaristic.
Well, he did the obligatory. You know, we're the big dog, and if you get in our way, we're going to squash you like a bug kind of thing. I mean, had he not done that, the Republicans would be yelling and screaming about him. But he didn't take it where Bush took it. You know, hey, there's three countries. They're the axis of evil. It's North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, and we're going to go after, you know, I mean, he didn't do any of that kind of stuff. So I think it was more rhetorical than literal.
Well, I took a degree in philosophy from a Jesuit university myself, and I've tended to branch out into other forms of spirituality since then. And I would like to say that I think I listen to what you say about global warming and then the people who deny it, and I definitely would say that there is global warming and that it is caused by human efforts.
Mm.
But I'm in the group that says that it's actually more than that, that actually human group consciousness creates all of the effects on planet Earth. And so going for a particular cause like CO2 may be a distraction. In other words, if we removed all the CO2, I'm not sure it would fix the problem. I'm definitely in favor of alternative energy sources, of peace-based energy. But I think what we need to do is group consciousness, kind of like what our friend Marianne Williamson talks about.
Yeah, I agree, Scott. I think we need to resacralize the world. It's I really believe that this is the key to everything, is to once again, and I say once again because humans once did this, to once again see everything in the world as alive and sacred, and every bit as alive and sacred as are we. Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Out of that thinking, that resacralized thinking, that resacredness, will come the obvious solution. Media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I have not yet started to drink coffee. I haven't taken a break yet. I've been sitting here before behind the microphone. I'll get there. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Hack. What's up?
People keep telling me there hasn't been any global warming for 15 years. And what do I say to that?
Well, let's see. That's sort of like saying that in 1960, you made $20,000. In 1970, you made $50,000. In 1980, you only made $5,000. In 1990, you only made $3,000. In 2000, you only made $5,000. And in 2010, you made $50,000 again. And saying, hey, you haven't had a change in income since 1970. You get what I'm saying? It's nonsense. In 1997, we had one unusually, spectacularly hot year. But if you take the trend line for the last 50 years, basically, year by year or decade by decade, what you see is that every decade has been warmer than the previous, and with the exception of 1997, every year has been warmer than the previous, or at least every 2 or 3 year block has been warmer than the previous. So what it proves, Hack, is the old saying that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Look at a year by year chart of global temperatures, and you will see exactly what I'm talking about. Does it make sense? Have I explained this?
Well, the people I speak to about this say that there's more and more CO2 being pumped into the atmosphere, but the warming isn't occurring as was predicted.
The warming, there's actually some truth to that, sort of. The warming is occurring as predicted back in the 70s and the 80s. In the 90s, it really started warming up, and they projected that through the 2000s, that warming, atmospheric warming, would start really picking, that we'd see. Right now we're about a degree warmer than we were 50 years ago, Celsius, about a year, degree, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. And they were projecting about 0.2 degrees more than that. And so in 2012, when they looked back and they said, okay, where did that go? Turns out that the carbon dioxide, at a certain level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the oceans actually start absorbing the carbon dioxide. So the temperature warming of the atmosphere is continuously going up, but it's not going up quite as fast as one of the IPCC projections back about a decade and a half ago. It still is going up. And the reason why this is really bad news is because all that CO2 going into the oceans causes this, the carbon dioxide in the oceans combines with free hydrogen ions, I believe it is, or something. Anyhow, it forms carbonic acid. Carbonic acid changes the pH, the acidity of the oceans. It lowers the pH of the oceans. And the lowering of the pH of the oceans is killing the coral, and it's starting to kill off the forms of life at the bottom of the food chain, which are all exoskeleton. They all have calcium external skeletons, little krill, and all the way up to things like oysters and crabs and things. They're starting to die off in shocking numbers because the ocean is so acidic now because it has absorbed this carbon dioxide. We're also seeing warming of the ocean that is greater than what's projected. Okay, so while the atmosphere is not warming quite as fast as what was projected, the ocean is warming much faster than was projected, particularly in the Arctic. We will see an ice-free Arctic probably within the next 10 to 20 years, whereas just 15 years ago they were projecting that the Arctic would be ice-free in the year 2100, you know, basically 100 years from then. So it's a serious crisis that we're not seeing that warming in the atmosphere, that it's happening in the oceans, because it means that the entire biosphere of the planet is now at risk. And if the oceans go, we have burned since 1850, we have lifted out of the ground and burned 300 billion tons of carbon. Okay, put that in your head, 300 billion tons. A trillion tons would be 1,000 billion tons, right? So there is 2,000 billion tons of carbon in the form of methane stored just in the Arctic, in the permafrost and frozen under the seas. That is about six times what we've burned since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. There's also another 2 trillion tons of carbon that the oil companies and the coal companies own and have on their books that they want to burn. So far we've burned 300 billion tons, and it's caused this 1 degree Celsius temperature rise. If we either warm up the Arctic, which is warmed, by the way, more than a degree. It's warmed about 2 degrees Celsius, about 5 degrees, 4 degrees Fahrenheit, because the poles warm faster than the center of the Earth, the equator. if we warm it enough that that methane in the Arctic starts to thaw and bubble up into the atmosphere, methane is about 100 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, we will see a sudden warming of this Earth. That has happened 5 times in the history of this planet. 5 times. Each one was called a mass extinction. The worst of them was the Permian mass extinction. 95% of all life on Earth died. In every one of the mass extinctions, more than half of all living things died. So we're standing on the edge of some really dangerous tipping points, in part because the atmosphere is not warming as fast as we predicted, but the seas are. And if the seas warm up and that methane that is frozen at the around the margins of the continents and the oceans, if that stuff goes soda pop, if that goes up into the atmosphere, it's game over. It's like it's the end of the human race, literally the end of the human race, and the end of anything larger than a cockroach on this planet. And it won't take a very long time to happen. It'll take maybe a few hundred years or a few thousand years. Whereas historically, these extinctions, like the Permian extinction, took 80,000 years because it was driven by natural processes. But we're pumping so much heat and so much carbon into the atmosphere. The Permian was triggered by a volcanic eruption in Siberia. It took 10,000 years for that volcanic eruption to raise the temperature, to produce enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to raise the temperature 5 degrees, which then ignited or triggered the methane in the oceans, which took us, which doubled the warming and killed off everything on Earth. And we're burning now carbon. We're producing carbon dioxide faster than the volcanoes were doing during the Permian mass extinction. It's really scary stuff, Hack. I wrote a book on this, which is available for 99 cents as an ebook over at Amazon.com and Apple iBooks and Barnes & Noble. It's called The Last Hours of Humanity. It just came out a few weeks ago. It's got all the science in it and all the charts. Yeah, and if you don't want to pay 99 cents, there's a lot of great websites on this stuff. The information is out there. And we're going to be having a release on a video and some more information over the next couple of days. So stay tuned. Okay? Hack, have I answered your questions?
I don't know. It sounded like a lot of jive.
Okay. Well, trust me, it's not. I suggest strongly that you check out the science. Laurel in Adrian, Minnesota. Hey, Laurel, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's an honor being on your program. Hack, I want to give a message to you, as opposed to giving out that long spiel on the technical part of global warming. You're from Oklahoma City, right? Just point to your southwest. There's this little place just off to your southwest called Moore. It's a town of about 30,000. And in the past 15 years, while people have been saying global warming doesn't exist, that town has been wiped off the map 3 times. 3 times in the last 15 years by massive tornadoes. I mean, people in your own neck of the woods have been being punched in the gut by global warming time and time and time again. It doesn't take a big scientific explanation to point this out.
Yeah.
I mean, global warming hits home, and it's wiping people out here at home. I mean, I'm calling from Minnesota, but, you know, you folks down in Oklahoma should know this firsthand. Global warming is a force, and it is real.
Yeah, we've got 5% more moisture in the atmosphere right now, and that's why the storms are so much worse, so much more potent.
You know, so Hat, you know, next time somebody's talking to you about that, like I said, just point to more and say, this is coming. This isn't just coming. It is here, and it is here now. And if we don't act, it's going to be your doors that are blown off by the next storm.
Yeah.
You know, because this is real.
Well said, Laura.
Real.
Well said. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your comment. Patty in Beaverton, Oregon, listening on KBQ.com. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
Great.
I'm calling about that sideshow that Ted Cruz put on yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was really kind of disturbing is these Republicans just were beside themselves because they're so afraid that the plot behind the Affordable Care Act was to turn it into single payer. They
I wish.
Pardon me?
I wish.
Well, yeah, because they had mentioned that Harry Reid and that Nancy Pelosi and that Bernie Sanders had all mentioned that they wanted single payer, and that was the whole plot behind Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And it was just a sideshow.
Yeah. No, it was. I mean, it was Ted Cruz raising money for Ted Cruz.
It was an embarrassment to this country. People watch our Congress, and it's got to stop.
Yeah. Green eggs and ham. It's incredible. Patty, thank you for the call and for your comment and listening to the program. We will be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can drop in at TomHartman.com into our free live chat room. It's a hoot. Some of the finest minds on earth hang out there. Seriously. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And Victoria Jones is on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where Ellen is right now in South Sudan or on her way working on that charity. So, you know, check that out, GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Good. So what's going on in the world?
Well, I don't have any story on this. I just have a worldwide caution that within the last hour or so I've received from the State Department. So if any of your listeners are planning on traveling overseas to multiple places, but it's worldwide, Europe, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, they might want to check this out at state.gov, because the Department of State is saying that they're concerned about the continued threat of terrorist attacks. And it's extremely strongly worded, let me put this way. And it goes into enormous detail, both continent by continent and then country by country and organization by organization.
Wow.
In terms of what their concerns are. It's really extremely interesting.
Now, are these direct threats against Americans or against anybody from any country? I mean, is this are we watching the blowback from our plane empire and our little wars in the Middle East?
Or? They're talking about violence against U.S. citizens and interests against the world. So they're talking about threats to U.S. citizens. But they're also saying that, for example, in Europe, they say the current information suggests Al-Qaeda, its affiliated organizations, and other terrorist groups continue to plan terrorist attacks against U.S. and Western interests in Europe.
Do you think that the Kenyan attack falls into this basket, that they went after a mall that was largely Western-owned stores?
I think that was part of it. I think also it was a high-profile place to get. I mean, it was a wonderful place where you had people who were captive.
Right. Yeah. Remarkable.
Where you're going to get an awful lot of international attention.
Okay. Well, thanks for that heads up. I don't know that there's much anybody can do.
No,
I'm
just
guessing
want people to be aware.
I guess it's the State Department doing CYA. I mean.
It may be that more information has come out.
Yeah. Okay.
So they want people to know. And I think we'll know more about that in the next day or so.
Mm-hmm.
So following Republican Senator Ted Cruz's 21-hour, 19-minute talkathon, the Senate voted 100-0 to break off debate and move to consider the House legislation that would keep the government open next week, Democrats hope, and would defund Obamacare, Republicans hope.
Okay, now help me figure this out, Victoria.
I'll try.
Yesterday, Ted Cruz said this.
Yes.
He said this.
Any vote for cloture, any vote to allow Harry Reid to add funding for Obamacare with just a 51-vote threshold, a vote for cloture is a vote for Obamacare.
Now, did Ted Cruz vote for cloture?
Yeah, effectively, yeah, he did.
Are you as baffled by that as me?
I am. And interestingly, according to the New York Times, after the vote, Senator Mike Lee of Utah and a Cruz ally said Cruz never intended to oppose the motion to take up the bill.
Which is a vote for cloture.
Yeah, and that's contradicted by his words and everything he's done for the last several days.
In other words, it was all a stunt.
Yeah, Yeah, it's all the stuff.
Any
now,
idea how much money he's raised? I'm guessing.
They have been raising money, and I'm sure he will continue to raise money on the back of this, and plans to raise money in 3 years' time.
My bet would be he's probably raised around $3 or $4 million.
Oh, I'm sure he's raised a considerable amount. Yeah. Now, this is the first vote. There are more votes coming.
Mm-hmm.
Later this week, Harry Reid's going to introduce a new version of the House stopgap spending bill. But the big vote comes this weekend when Democrats have to try and win over 60 senators to cut off debate.
Right.
And that's when Cruz will try and stop them from getting 60 votes. But some Republicans are kind of like, Senator John McCain is saying there's no other way. As soon as we have 67 votes in the Senate, we'll win. Unfortunately, we're not even close. So, you know, even they are thinking of relenting. Anyway, apparently he hates Cruz so much.
Yes. Yeah. Cruz is upstaging him. It used to be John McCain was the guy that, you know, the go-to guy for the media.
Right.
You know, the old joke, the most dangerous place in Washington, D.C. is between John McCain and a camera.
Right.
I'm wondering, the Monsanto Protection Act was put back into this bill by the House when they sent it over to the Senate, and Jeff Merkley, the senator from Oregon, has been working very hard to get it taken out.
It's coming out.
Is it?
My understanding is, from what I was reading this morning, is that it's coming out. It's not coming out immediately. Now, bear in mind, I read this at 3, and I haven't read it since. It will be coming out in a few months' time. But it is coming out.
Very, but it expires pretty soon. Wasn't it just 3 months initially? And
I'm not sure, but what I read, there was a story on Politico about this morning.
Right.
But they are not renewing it. It always gets renewed.
Right. Okay.
I'll
have to track that down. Thank you.
Yeah, they are not renewing it.
Okay. What else is up?
Well, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew wrote to all lawmakers today warning leaders that he will exhaust emergency borrowing measures no later than October the 17th.
So that's the debt ceiling day.
That's debt ceiling day. And he'll have less than $30 billion on hand to pay the nation's bill. So that's like about $30 in your bank account.
Right.
And so he said, without additional borrowing authority, that cash on hand would be far short of net expenditures on certain days, which can be as high as $60 billion.
Hmm.
And so he urged the immediate action to raise the federal debt limit. Well, actually, that's what the House plans to do on Friday or Saturday. But
they're going to say you got to postpone Obamacare for a year.
Plus.
Okay.
They've got other plans.
Oh, my.
They want to increase Medicare means testing. They want to eliminate social service block grants and the fund for preventative health care in the Affordable Care Act. Coal and oil companies are going to benefit from provisions to expand offshore drilling and drilling on federal land and lots more.
So the Republicans in the House want to give more money to the billionaires and screw the poor people, basically.
You could say that.
In exchange for raising the debt ceiling. Incredible. Victoria Jones, thank you for your thoughtful, insightful, and brilliant presentation.
Thank you.
Always great having you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the previous hour. That was a fascinating conversation with Bill Donahue of the Catholic League, who is generally considered, you know, Fox News' best friend and this right-winger, you know, because of his positions on abortion and women and things like that. But the Pope has come out and criticized capitalism, and so did Bill Donahue. Oh, kind of blew my mind. And before that, Michael Elliott, the president of the One Campaign, was with us, and Frank Vernuccio of New York Analysis and Policy talking about our schools and how our schools have just fallen apart. It's really a sad thing. You look at the track of our schools, and I think because I was born at this particular point in time I mean, all of us, every one of us, you know, our perspective is dictated in some part by when we were born. But when I was either 6 or 7 years old, Sputnik went up. It was like 1956, 57. I think it was 56. Well, in 56, I would have been 5. So it had to be later than that. Maybe it was 67, 68. Anyhow, Sputnik went up when I was a kid. And I remember listening to it as it went over, bing, 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 you know, with my friend's shortwave radio. And everybody in America was freaked out, right? The Soviets put up a satellite. And it was just a beacon. It was just going, bing, bing, bing. And you could watch it go across the sky at night. And Dwight Eisenhower responded to that by saying, we are going to raise a generation of scientists. And it's funny, the one, how, you know, our memory is and all this kind of stuff. The one time I tried to get this on, I suggested to a friend to put this on my Wikipedia page. This is like 5 years ago or something, about how when I was in the second grade, as I recall, and it might have been third, but I'm pretty sure it was second grade, Eisenhower dumped all this money into special education and said, let's identify the brightest kids in America and put them on a special track. And I was, myself and a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Terry, in that second grade class in that school, that elementary school, and there were other kids from other grades, were pulled out halftime of our normal classes and were allowed to study absolutely anything we wanted as fast as we wanted. It was amazing. I was so grateful for that. And when the person put it up on the Wikipedia page, I mean, there's no links to any of this stuff anymore because this all happened before the Internet even existed, right? This was like 58, 57. And so somebody said, all right, you can't have that. There's no link. But by the time I was done, and I'm not the only one who had this experience. I've had, you know, a lot of people over the years tell me that they were in similar programs. By the time I was graduated from elementary school, 12 years old, out of sixth grade, going into seventh grade, two things had happened. One was I basically had completed a high school education. I mean, I had had 2 years of Spanish. I had had a year of Latin. I was playing the violin. I was doing science. I was doing math. I had geometry, elementary calculus. I understood what trigonometry was. I was reading Shakespeare. I mean, it's like we had just. I had studied psychology, I had studied biology, I mean, just whatever I was interested in, they would find a teacher and help me learn this stuff. It was so cool. Terry and I had so much fun. In fact, they were, I told this story once a long time ago, but it's worth telling again. I just want to talk about education for a minute. They were so concerned that maybe these kids who were in this like super advanced learning class, because this has never been tried before, and you can nuke the daily take, that we were being mentally damaged by learning so much so fast, that my recollection is it was every 3 months, but keep in mind, I mean, this was when I was 7, 8 years old, so it was a long time ago. My memory might be wrong. It might have been more or less frequent, but I remember having to go down to the nurse's office, the school nurse's office in my elementary school, and take a Rorschach test and take, the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Inventory, and other kinds of tests to find out if I was being psychologically or emotionally damaged by learning so much stuff so fast. And in fact, I wasn't. And by the time I was 14, I'd gotten a summer scholarship to go to Michigan State University, and I wrote a paper called "The Effects of the Mutagen Colchicine on Aspergillus niger and Rhizobius niger canis, Two Black Bread Molds." And then we, my lab partner and I, did another thing where we tried to use DNase to dissolve the DNA in the nucleolus of a macroscopic water plant cell, and see if we could then put new DNA and bring it back to life, right? This is long before anybody was doing this kind of stuff. We were unsuccessful, by the way. But the paper on colchicine as a mutagen worked really well, and I presented that, and that was my thesis for that summer. So 14 years old, MSU. But this nurse, this like fresh out of, or she wasn't a nurse, she was a psychologist, fresh out of psychology school, fresh out of education school, whatever, this sweet young thing. My friend Terry, his dad was a shrink. He was a psychologist. And he had a book on the Rorschach test. And so Terry and I dug it out and we read up on the test that we were taking. Ho-ho. That's dangerous. So we decided to split this thing up. And my recollection is that he took violence and I took sex, although it might have been the other way around, but I'm pretty sure that that's the way it was. And so she gave us the Rorschach test, the ink blot test, right? This is the ink blot test. And I'm going, you know, whoa, look at what they're doing behind that keyhole. And people, you shouldn't be showing pictures like this to little kids. And isn't that illegal? You know, just like reacting as if I'm seeing these incredibly sexualized images when it's just ink blots. And Terry was reacting like, you know, oh, my God, the blood. And they so freaked out that my parents and Terry's parents and Terry and I and the teacher and our regular teacher and our special ed teacher and the principal, we had this meeting in the school one night at 7 o'clock. We all had to go to this meeting. And this poor young thing, you know, told us that she thought that our brains were getting warped. And then we tried to tell her that, no, we read Terry's dad's book on the Rorschach test and we punked you. And her self-respect was at risk. And so she said, you know, no, you guys are twisted. And we were like,
he is the
not.
Only man to ever ace a Rorschach test.
There you go. Thank you, Shane. And so anyhow, I don't remember how that story ended other than that we were allowed to continue with this accelerated education. But I said that two things happened by the time I graduated from elementary school and went on to junior high school. The first was that I had learned all that stuff. The second was that the war in Vietnam was starting. And as the war in Vietnam cranked up, Eisenhower's money, because it was no longer Eisenhower, it was Kennedy, Eisenhower's money for special education went away. And there was no program in my junior high school or in my high school like there was in my elementary school. And so I ended up, I was in high school, I was publishing an underground newspaper. My co-editor just sent me an email a couple months ago. First time I'd heard from him in 30 years. I got kicked out of high school for publishing this underground newspaper, and it was a great thing. It was the best thing that could have happened to me because I took a GED and I was able to immediately go into college. Went to LCC, Lansing Community College. But it's like, why aren't we funding our gifted kids? We stopped educating gifted kids when the Vietnam War started. And ever since then, we have been putting hundreds of billions of dollars a year into war and virtually nothing into our gifted children. Our school system is so screwed up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So anyhow, I don't have any instant solutions other than that I think that we really should be funding education differently. We should be doing it differently. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Just a quick reminder, many of our nonprofit stations, our Pacifica stations, are in fundraising drives right now. Free Speech TV is having a fundraising drive right now, our membership drive. And our commercial radio stations, they don't do fund drives, but you can, if you're listening to us on a commercial radio station, you can support our program and that station by calling the sponsors that you hear on during the commercial breaks and saying, you know, if I ever need your product, I'm going to buy it. And or if one of my friends does, I'll tell them about it. I just want you to know that I'm listening. It's you'd be astounded. A sponsor for a local commercial radio station getting even 4 or 5 calls like that a year is like a big deal. It's a really big deal. So support, if it's a nonprofit station you're listening, support the station. If it's nonprofit television you're watching, support the network. If it's for-profit radio that you're listening to, support the sponsors. These are the ways that you can help keep good progressive talk radio going in the United States. Not just, this is not true of just my show, of any, you know, whatever you may happen to be listening to and participating with. Mary in Tinley Park, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Mary.
Hello, can you hear me?
I do, just fine.
Oh, hi, I just had a comment about education.
Mm-hmm.
My son graduated high school, I would say, 5 years ago. So it wasn't that long ago. And I remember when he was able to take world history, and he was maybe a sophomore.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me that he was so happy that he didn't have to learn about the pilgrims again. He was able to actually learn, you know, something about the world.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I was walking, so I got a little out of breath. But, you know, this was a kid who he did his homework because he had to. You know, he wasn't especially into it. And it was the first time I'd heard him, you know, have any real interest, I would say. You know, and I wondered, had he felt that way about more of his classes, you know, what it might have been like for him.
Yeah. Yeah. In other words, he finally found something that he was enjoying, or was being taught in a way that he enjoyed it. And he got on fire for education, or he at least started enjoying education.
And, right, and
he was learning about the world.
Right, and instead of, you know, they learned the story of the pilgrims.
Yeah,
every year.
I know. And the pilgrims isn't even a really good story of the founding of America, because the pilgrims are an eccentric religious sect. They weren't actually the first founders. It was the people from Jamestown, and that was a corporate colony organized by the British East India Company, which typically isn't taught, you know, to our students that, you know, America was founded by the world's largest corporation. They named it after King James, who was the largest stockholder in the East India Company. They named the state Virginia, where Jamestown was, after the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, who was the one who created the charter for the British East India Company. You know, and so instead they tell you the story about the pilgrims, and they don't tell you that the pilgrims came here because when they tried to run England under Cromwell and ban dancing and singing, that the people in England said, to heck with that, kick them out. You know, and so they came over here and they tried to ban dancing and singing and you know, burn women at the stake. Actually, they hung more women, or they tossed them in ponds to see if they sank, to find out if there were witches. I mean, the pilgrims have a pretty bizarre history. Anyhow, Mary, thanks for calling. Thanks for sharing. I appreciate the story. Gus in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Gus, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I'm a New York City school teacher, 7 years, and I can tell you firsthand what happened to gifted programs, especially in the inner city, where they're really important, because what you're trying to do is get kids into specialized high school, and they can get out of their low-performing neighborhood schools.
Right.
About three or four years ago, they made the decision that they wanted not to stigmatize the other classes, and so they didn't want to call them gifted classes anymore because that might hurt the feelings of the other kids. And what they did was they started distributing kids that are various IEPs or disabilities, you know, they have learning issues. Mm-hmm. What they start to do is distribute them like evenly across all the classes so that, you know, they monopolize the teacher's time.
Right.
Pretty much every period, every day. And so instead of maximizing learning, they're really putting out fires and
right.
trying to calm
and then,
down.
And then you see what I experienced when I hit seventh grade, which is an explosion of ADHD behavior, because here I am in seventh grade and having to restudy geometry, which I already, introduction to geometry, which I had to take because it was seventh grade curriculum. And I was doing calculus. I mean, you know, I was like, and so what am I doing? I'm fidgeting. And the teacher's going, oh, this kid's hyperactive, right?
Right. You know, when you take a kid that's kind of on the borderline and you put them in a classroom with, you know, a kid that might be, jumping on the chair or trying to leave the room every 2 seconds.
Yeah.
What that does is it really stresses out all the other kids. And so, you know, the thinking was that the other kids were going to calm, you know, these kids down. But it's
no,
really
it works the other way around. It works the other way around.
Yeah.
So, and I don't remember being called gifted when I was a kid. I knew that it was a special education program. In fact, I think it was called special education, but which has a very different meaning now. But that's a shame. That's just a shame. I understand the logic behind it, Gus, but I'm sorry to hear that. Thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. We got a minute to the break. Steve, it's yours.
Yeah, I just think that if we kind of start working together on global warming, we can probably solve it fairly quickly.
course, the cold direct chemical looping is a good idea. There are certain forms of nuclear power that would work and would be safe and actually recycle and eliminate high-level nuclear radiation.
The one thing that would be, I have two simple solutions. One is to resacralize the world, to view everything as living and sacred, and to stop thinking that the world is a dead machine. We need to fix the machine and start thinking of it as a living organism. We have to heal it. And the second is to say that any carbon that is emitted is waste, and you have to pay a waste disposal fee, just like when you take out the trash. $100 a ton for the carbon tax. That $100 a ton for carbon tax will cause every other form of energy that is not carbon-based to suddenly become very, very economical. And the marketplace, as much as I hate to say it, will actually solve the problem. Thanks a lot, Steve, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Actually, I shouldn't hate to say it, because what we're doing is we're redefining the marketplace by putting that carbon tax into place. Marketplaces, of course, are created by governments.
Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you.
And, interesting. Charles in Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was listening to you earlier, and I think you have what is the start of a new book to research.
Yeah.
Because I bet if you would go and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs' family, just question them, I would bet that the founder of Oracle, all of these people were in advanced study classes like you were, and I was in some when I was a child too, and basically, you know, the gains that people get from these programs is incalculable.
Yeah, they're extraordinary. They're absolutely extraordinary. If you let kids learn as fast as they can learn, and I would say, you know, quote, average IQ kids, and I don't have any idea what my IQ is now, but I know when I was in fourth or fifth grade, you know, they tested us, and Terry was 142 and I was 141. He would never let me forget it. He was a point higher than me. He'd call me 141. but in any case, 100 is average. I think that kids with 100 IQs, if they're put in an environment where they can learn stuff that they really care about, kids with 80 IQs, if they're put in environments where they can learn stuff that they really care about, they're gonna fly. They're gonna sail on. I actually, Charles, for anybody who might be interested in the topic of education, I wrote a book called Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD, and there is a chapter in there on gifted programs, and I share my story about the gifted program. I believe I wrote this book about a decade and a half ago, and I haven't read it since I wrote it, but I'm pretty sure it's in there, and I'm pretty sure my own story is in there. I know that there's a chapter on gifted programs, and there's also a chapter on the history of education that goes back to the Spinnenschulen and Marie Theresa, the Empress of Austria in the 1770s, starting these schools/places where kids could do weaving work. So I guess I've already started that book. But yeah, good idea, Charles. Somebody needs to write a good book on bringing in our gifted programs. Thanks a lot for the call. Laura in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Laura, you wanted to weigh in on the gifted programs?
Sure. Hi, 141.
I don't think it's actually that high because when I was 13 or 14, I took the Mensa test and I flunked it. I did not get into Mensa. And then here's the funny end of that story. 3 years ago, Mensa invited me to keynote their annual convention. And so I opened the speech by saying that, you know, I'd been kicked out of Mensa or I'd never got in, you know, and everybody thought that was hysterical. Mensa is my younger brother, Steve, just got into Mensa and he's trying to get me into it now. So anyhow, back to you, Laura.
First of all, I'm 52 years old and I have a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I have nothing but time in life anymore. You know, just, yeah. I'm not in a hurry with anything. And so we spend a lot of time with my boy, and I use the Socratic method with him when he comes home and helps him to learn. And so he consequently, he's a pretty smart kid, and he's gotten into all this gifted. There's a whole magnet program in St. Louis that's just for gifted.
Really? Oh, that's
and
great.
Yes.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yes, it is. And it's, you know, and as a matter of fact, the history of the public schools in St. Louis is really kind of interesting because they were like the first school to offer a public school for African-American people in the west of the Mississippi in the history of America.
Whoa.
And also they were the first, they patterned the kindergarten. A woman named Susan Blow, she learned it from the Germans. Her family was German, and she started a kindergarten as a public school.
Right, which is a German word, by the way. It means child garden.
Yes, exactly. Right. Kindergarten is the German for child garden. But anyway, the way they take care of it, but you do have to qualify for this kind of program. And I think, though, my biggest frustration when I watch how children are taught, you know, and I have a lifetime now, you know, of understanding how you learn, is I think the failure came with the public schools when they stopped rewarding children for success and discipline, self-discipline, you know, because and all they do is worry about self-esteem constantly.
Yeah.
And I think that works pretty good when you're a little kid. But at some point when you hit about 9 or 10 years old, you realize, hey, man, you know, I'm not that good. And then the cynicism sets in.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time they're 12, they are so cynical about it. They're like, yeah, whatever, you know, because they've been told their whole lives how wonderful they are and how great they are. And it's fine when you're little. But once you start getting about 9 or 10, you can compare yourself and you realize you're not so great anymore.
Yeah. And the reward mechanism that is wired, it's actually part of the interaction between the limbic brain and the orbitofrontal part of the brain. You know, there's a reward system that there's a natural one, and then there's one that develops as a result of acculturation of life experience.
Exactly.
And that reward system gets distorted by these things.
And they don't trust what they hear. They don't trust the adults anymore.
Right.
And that's a real shame. And especially their teachers, who are the most important people in their lives. Really, they see them longer every day than their own parents usually.
Yep.
So that's my story.
Okay, brilliant, Laura. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for calling. Ed in Chicago. Hey, Ed.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
My son was one of those children that was misdiagnosed with HDAD or ADHD. When he was in second or third grade, the teacher said that he was out of control, he had too much energy, he needed to be medicated. They put him on Ritalin, and his reading scores suffered because he didn't have any interest, he didn't have any drive. His math scores all suffered.
Right.
Then about 2 years later, we transferred schools because we moved, and we got lucky enough to find a teacher that actually recognized that it wasn't an ADHD problem, or he had more advanced knowledge than what he was being.
Right. He was a gifted kid who was bored by a slow school.
Right. So what she did is she actually brought us in and said that she didn't think that he needed the medication. To take him off the medication, and she gave him the chance that when he was completed with all of his assigned work in class, that he would be allowed to go to the back of the class, grab any book he wanted, and he could sit there and read.
Wow.
And in doing that, he went from, in fourth grade, a second grade reading level, to by the time he was in fifth grade, reading at a ninth grade reading level.
Yep.
All because one teacher recognized that there was more to it than just pushing it off, and we didn't want to deal with the extra energy. It wasn't extra energy. He was bored to death at what he was learning because he knew he was smarter than what they were giving him credit for.
God bless her.
Now, what ended up happening is in high school, when I was in school, because I was a product of the Chicago public school system, when I was in high school, when you took your classes in high school, you had electives, and if you filled your electives and you didn't need to take any more of your required classes, you could take required classes from the year, the following year, and bottle them up into the year before.
Right.
So, in essence, you could graduate from high school as a junior if you figured it out right.
Right.
Well, when he hit high school, they wouldn't allow him to do that. He only needed one individual credit in his senior year that would have only carried him through the first half of the year. They wouldn't allow him to take.
That's crazy.
That one credit, so he couldn't graduate early. They wanted to keep him in school.
Oh, because they're getting paid for it.
The year.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
They want to keep that extra body in there. That's federal funding. And I thought it was really unfair. And he, when he applied to college, he got accepted to UIC. And when he applied to college, it was the only college he ever applied to. And I'm like, you know, you need to spread your options out. And he goes, I know I can do this. This is the school I'm going to go to.
Yeah.
And
good on him.
Lucky enough, actually got into UIC.
That is
great. But all of this starts because one teacher recognized that you don't need to medicate every kid out there.
God bless her. It is, Ed, thank you for sharing that story. And that's the power. I mean, it's just the power of recognizing gifted kids and the gifts within normal kids, by the way, because I don't think that there's any such thing as average. And I think that kids have different kinds of intelligences. Some kids may have musical intelligence. Some kids might have academic intelligence. Some kids might have mathematical intelligence. I mean, recognize their intelligence and let them go with that as fast and as far as they can. Cheryl in Santa Barbara listening on KPFK. Hey, Cheryl, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to call because when my son was in the third grade, he got into GATE because he did so well in school.
What is GATE?
At my school, the GATE program is a program here for gifted kids.
Okay.
However, what I discovered when I was going through that process was that the families here who have money pay $600 or more to have their kids prepare for the GATE test. And I spoke out against that, stating that, well, if the families can't afford it, they should at least make tests available on their website of sample GATE tests. In fact, there was a second grade class at Washington School, and the whole class passed the GATE test 1 year. When the class that the Dubin Learning Center was using was the exact test that was given for GATE assessment. So in Santa Barbara, I argue in my book, An Autobiography of a Single Mother, I see that the GATE program funded by our taxpayers are used for the haves versus the have-nots.
Oh, geez.
So therefore, I don't agree with this.
Because of the entry,
program.
Because of the entry test. And that, which gets us back to kind of the standardized education. Everybody fits in the same little box, fill in the test thing. Tests are crazy. It should be because a teacher has gotten to know a student and sees some spark there, and which means that we need to have the kind of teachers who can spot that, which means we need to pay our teachers better. Cheryl, got about 10 seconds.
Okay, and then the school district claims you can't prepare for a test. I'm a high school dropout. I took the GED and I by math was my law degree. But the first thing I was taught in program for the GED was how to prepare for a test.
There you go. There you
go.
Yeah, I agree. Cheryl, thank you for listening to KPFK. Thanks for the call. Brilliant.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. Back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Liz in Cary, Illinois. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. I'd like to talk with you about, the fact that I agree with you about the gifts-differing aspect of identification of gifted children. I personally have had two very bright children, and my daughter was not labeled as gifted. My son was, only because he was retested by a teacher who recognized that he was different.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'd like to talk with you about is what I've noticed with my son by having been separated. I mean, when my daughter was young, everybody in the class knew she was really bright. They always know she's really bright. My son was separated into the gifted program in the sixth grade, and it affected his self-image in such a way that he felt that he was different than the other kids and such, and not in a good way.
Right.
And he became very obsessed with ethics and justice and love and that sort of thing. And even though he's a math mind, he was writing poetry and love poetry at that age. And I'm just wondering how you feel about how labeling children like this affects their entire view of the world.
I can relate to his experience. I think because Terry and I were pulled out of that class, we were Dennis, I'm so want to say his last name, but I'm not going to do it on the air. The school bully was a kid named Dennis. And I had to walk by his house to get home, and he used to beat the crap out of me every chance he got. And I did not participate in sports with the other kids. My, you know, fortunately, my teachers would let me just avoid the sports because I was always the last one picked for all the teams. I would sit, there's this giant oak tree out behind our elementary school, and I would sit there and read during recess. And I did feel like a kid apart, and I got into poetry when I was a teenager and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Bob Dylan was my hero, and Dylan Thomas, and E.E. Cummings, and I could still recite a lot of this stuff from memory. Even, you know, back to Whitman. And at the time, there were people, including my mother, who were very concerned that I was becoming an introvert and I was becoming an outcast. And, you know, is this going to turn out badly? In retrospect, I mean, I've had a lot of years to look back on it now. I think that those things, certainly they shaped me and they helped make who I am, and I don't think they did so in a bad way. I think that we all have our challenges in life. I'm sure that Dennis the Bully had his challenges in life. In fact, I know that his father used to beat him with a belt badly, and that probably had a lot to do with why he tried to beat me, you know. And that separation or that definition or that you're special or you're not or you're, you know, teacher's pet or whatever, I am far less concerned about that than whether the kids are simply allowed to live up to their potential. I think that eventually, as we grow up, we sort out the social stuff. And I've never been a social animal. I'm an introvert who has learned how to pretend he's an extrovert. I do it on the radio and television. But you put me in a room with 15 or 20 people, and I'm scared to death. If I'm standing up on stage, I'm okay. But if I have to be at a cocktail party, you know, I'll do them for our radio stations and things, I'm terrified. I'm not good in social situations. And so, you know, but hey, at a certain level, you just say, hey, okay, that's who I am. And this is why I mentioned Goddard. I wasn't here Monday because Goddard College gave me an honorary PhD in Humane Arts and Letters, and I had to fly out to get it. And they teach like this. You know, they teach to the student. Every student is individually taught. And I think that that's so cool and so important. Denmark has the best educational system in the world by any measurement, literally any measurement. In Denmark, it's harder to become a teacher than it is to become a doctor, and they pay the teachers the same as they pay their MDs. We should be doing this stuff in the United States. So that's my thoughts on that, Liz. And thanks for raising the issues. I'm going to pick up some more phone calls here. Thank you. Nick, and I'm not sure where you're calling from, Nick, but you're listening to WCPT, so it must be Chicago area?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
What's up?
Caller earlier said that you have a new subject to research in your book, and if you are interested, we know the answer to the to how schools should be run, and it's not like it is. I've done some research. The school system that we operate under is not even designed to teach kids. It's designed to sort kids.
Oh, I know. Like Horace Mann pitched it to Commerce.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wrote a chapter about that in Complete Guide. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in 1974, there was something called the New Model School Project, where school was done decidedly differently. In Chicago, that's the way charter schools were sold, different ways to do schools, and that's not exactly what happened, as we know. But anyway, out of the, I believe, seven schools out of the New Model School Project, one survived. It was called Bishop Carroll, and it was in Canada. However, despite its name, it's not a parochial school. The way Canadians fund their schools are different. You could have a parochial school that actually becomes a public school for all intents and purposes. But there are no classes. There's a set curriculum, and kids go through it at their own pace, but it's tightly regulated. These kids are watched. They have benchmarks that they have to hit. They're meeting every week with an advisor. All right, you did great in math. We got to work on your reading.
Right.
And it's brilliant.
It's personalization.
Yes.
It's personalization. I mean, we have gone to this factory model. We've Henry Fordized our schools, and we need to go back to every car made by hand, you know, every child raised by hand. And it's a little more expensive to do it that way. Like I said, Denmark, you know, they spend a lot on education. Boy, do they get the results. Nick, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing that and great information. Coming up tomorrow, you know, I'll... What's Ted Cruz up to next? Who knows?
the Republicans' latest tricks and any. We'll continue with the news of the day. But don't forget. Oh, and tomorrow, Geeky Science, my favorite segment of the week, because I'm a total science geek. But don't forget, democracy requires you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag you're it. And if you're watching or listening on a non-commercial venue, support their fund drive. It's a commercial station. Support their sponsors. Thank you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.